Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Raj Rana.
And I'm Dan Clayton. On this episode of Lexis, we're really pleased to be joined by Christian Ilbury, who is a lecturer in linguistics and English language in the School of Philosophy, Psychology and Language Sciences at the University of Edinburgh. So thanks very much for joining us, Christian.
Sure, thank you.
One of the reasons, I mean, we've wanted to talk to you for a long time, Christian. And in fact, we were just talking beforehand thinking we both thought we probably had. But we definitely haven't interviewed you before, but you've written loads and loads of really interesting articles and papers. And I think one of the things that's particularly interesting about some of the stuff you've done is some of the titles of your papers and some of the topics that you cover. So you've got one called You OK, Hun? The Digital Commodification of White Woman Style. You've got Thank You, Love, The Science of Hun Culture. You've got probably one of my favourites, The Recontextualization of Multicultural London English, aka Stylizing the Roadman. And then probably the one that will get us our explicit warning slapped on this episode, They're Serving What? How the C word went from camp to mainstream, which was in the conversation, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And your biography says that you're interested in, you know, topics like, is there a TikTok accent? What's the function of lol in WhatsApp conversations?
Yeah.
Does social media cause language change?
Yeah.
Does that kind of make you the most online linguist we've interviewed so far?
Well, I'm like definitely online a lot. So I guess that means that I probably study like digital or online communication probably more so than the average sociolinguist. Yeah, I guess like I was looking at, you know, language. I'm interested in language variation and change. And I was increasingly interested in the fact that not very many people were thinking about how does this go with the digital, right? Like I am somebody that uses a lot of social media. Like I'm part of the generation that David Pacenti referred to as the digital natives, which now for various reasons has been problematized, but we at least know that like our generation use a lot of social media. So I was thinking like, well, it's interesting to think about how, like what we do in the offline, how we speak, how we interact might be impacted or influenced by what we do online. Like how does how we write on Twitter, for instance, how does that relate to what we're doing when we're interacting with someone in face-to-face communication? And because I'm interested in youth language, obviously that's relevant to young people, like, you know, as former teachers or as people who are educators, that young people use social media in ways that are really interesting. And so putting those two together, I think, gives us a more like holistic picture of language variation change.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking about my A-level teaching. When we look at articles, perhaps about young people's language, often, you know, there's discourses of decline and, or sloppiness or and things like that, and suggestions that, you know, young people are ruining language. We also see quite a lot of discourses that suggest that social media is kind of ruining the English language. So what would be your answer to that then?
Yeah, so I mean, like, obviously, as a sociolinguist, when we unpick those discourses, it's often about language change, right? People start to fear language change as this negative thing. And we as sociolinguists just don't believe that discourse, right? We think that language change is a good thing. It's always happened. And we actually just need to embrace that change. So clearly, we don't speak the same way as Shakespeare, for instance. And, you know, lots of those reasons are because of social differences, social changes. And I think people overestimate the influence of social media on language change. Yeah, sure, it's important. But people often think that, like, you know, when there's a new technology, language is changing and therefore it must be with regard to or related or impacted directly by that technology. So like even the discourses of like at the moment, people are talking about TikTok voice. Like as a particular voice or accent that has apparently come from TikTok. But if you look like 5 years ago, people were talking about Instagram voice or like YouTube voice. It is just when we have something new, people assume that that newness is going to lead to new linguistic practices. And I think it's always really important to contextualize what you have on that platform in relation to what people are doing already offline. Like a lot of TikTok voice is just what people did already, right? Like, I mean, I always try when I have these discussions with like journalists, like try and relate like an influencer style to something like QVC, like the shopping channel, right? Like you see similar linguistic strategies on that channel because it's the same kind of like attention economy. You want people to listen to you. You want people to not switch off the TV. So you use like high-rising terminals, right? So you say like, this is a really interesting product, right? Or you use like, you know, interesting styles of discourse to engage the audience. So I think we have long rejected the idea that language change is a negative thing and people will always try and relate it to something new or young people because they're at the forefront of linguistic change usually. And I don't think this is a negative thing. I think it's actually a really positive thing because young people forever try to establish their identities as young people as different from older people. And one of the ways of doing that is language. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. So do you think social media is causing language change in some ways?
This is a great question. It's a great question because like, I think if you stop someone on the street and you ask them and they'd be like, yes, like straight away, no questions. Absolutely. Yes. But if you look at the literature in sociolinguistics, people have been very unsure about this possibility. In fact, like people like Peter Drucker, you know, who we think of like as one of the founding fathers of the field, like explicitly dismisses this in like a 2014 article where he calls media influence irrelevant to language change, right? And I think one way of understanding this is what people mean by language change. So in sociolinguistics, we're using that to refer to like, here is some structural element of language, like phonology or grammar. And at one point, someone said it like, I don't know, let's take the word happy. So in received pronunciation, that would have been something more like hippie and now is more like happy. So you hear there's language change in the pronunciation of that vowel. So the idea then is that media would have some impact or influence on the pronunciation of particular vowels, right? That's one question. Does media lead to like changes in pronunciation or accent? And like, according to like people like Peter Chuggirl, Labov, that is not possible because it's face-to-face interaction in which you have these minor accommodations of possible changes over time. Lexis, both of them say Lexis, so words, cool. Yeah, like Peter Trugill talks about like using the word freshman, I think it is, having never come into contact with somebody who'd use this, but had read a lot of American literature. And I think we could probably all think of like examples of people picking up words that from TV programs that they watch. So that's fine. I think Lexis is slightly different. But phonology, grammar, at least according to these kind of theorists, that's not possible. And so lots of people have argued instead that we are kind of thinking about this in the wrong way. So media influence and language change, people like Yanis Sandrasopoulos have argued that actually what we need to be thinking about is media and mediatization and sociolinguistic change. So not necessarily like this kid watches Peppa Pig and then starts to sound like a British person, right? But rather like this young person engages with a lot of, I don't know, African-American cultural forms like films and TV programs, and therefore starts to align with some of the identities in that show or that film. And so recasting it from language change to sociolinguistic change means that we can think about how media might do things like circulate particular representations of speakers or affect language ideology. So this is much broader understanding of how media might lead to sociolinguistic changes, which I think is how we should be looking at it, right? Yeah, and how I've looked at it. I think the case of like, does, I don't know, watching Top Boy lead someone to like adopt an MLE accent? Like, I think that's too simplistic. I think we need to think about it more in terms of like, how does that individual engage with those cultural forms and how might they configure their understanding of MLE or as people who use MLE or possibilities for their own linguistic practice? So it's much more complex.
Yeah.
But just to check that I'm following you, is it more about media offering possible kind of choices for identity and then people performing identities that, that they through language.
Yeah, exactly that. So like, if you think about where sociolinguistics has come from, so looking at isolated features and correlations with macro demographic categories like particular ages or genders, and then now we're looking less at isolated features, more towards how people use features to perform like stereotypical personae or align or reject those personae. And I think that kind of re-theorization of how we approach language change and language variation also is useful to understanding how people engage with media. Like I said, like I don't think like young people specifically watch like a program and think, oh, or don't even think, just like absorb like a pronunciation over time and then acquire that pronunciation. But I think they might start to watch something and think, hey, that like culture is really cool. And then they're probably doing other things than just watching the program to engage with that culture. And then over time, they might start to perform that identity in their own linguistic practice. So it's not like a direct cause and effect. It's much more like engagement, mediatized engagement.
Yeah, that's really interesting because it sort of, it reminded me a bit of media studies theory around, you know, that kind of idea around the hypodermic syringe model in media, where it's like the audience are kind of injected with something and suddenly they take, you know, so like the Peppa Pig example.
Yeah.
It's too reductive, isn't it, as you say?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, like if you look at when people were thinking about language change in media, their engagement with media studies is basically nothing, right? Mm. Like it was, do people watch TV and acquire some of the features there? This very like linguistic approach to how someone might acquire something. And I think that was the problem, is they were focused on one type of media, television, which is not, at least in the level of like face-to-face interaction, it's not interactive, right? And they were also focused on like cause and effect. Whereas now the approach to mediatization and sociolinguistic change allows us to think about interactive social media, right? Where even in this context, like we're on a Zoom call, this is face-to-face interaction. So sure, it might not be like, you guys are not in Edinburgh, I'm in a different geographical location. But if we want to assume that Trudgill's argument about face-to-face accommodation is the primary means through which language change happens, then we now have it. So I think it is much more complex than simply just dismissing media as irrelevant. I just don't think that's, like, bearing in mind I've done a lot of research in this area, and I don't think any of my papers could even conclude that was a possibility. No. I think all of my papers
you'd be out of a job if you said that.
I think all my papers show that social media is incredibly relevant to contemporary forms of social interaction.
Yeah. I was just thinking as well about the, you know, the examples of, you know, kids. There's always sort of anecdotes, aren't there, about, oh, this kid has watched this and now they talk like that. But it's like you say, they're doing it for different reasons. So, I mean, a friend of mine was saying about how his like 6-year-old son was talking in a kind of YouTube voice, where instead of saying goodbye, he'd be saying, remember to like and subscribe.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was a performance. It was a joke. It wasn't like this is the only way he said goodbye. It was like he liked that identity, wanted to perform it. It was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like the other thing about like assuming language change. So the Peppa Pig example is good because lots of people say like, oh, this is Peppa Pig leading to language change. Like we're going to have a whole generation of American kids who sound British, but like they're just watching that for like a period of time. And they might use that in like the following months, but do they actually like have that as their linguistic system? No. Mm. Like we know as linguists that like the most influential thing on like a child's linguistic practice is the community, right? Like they aren't away from the parents. They go into the community and they acquire the community norms. Like if all their friends are not saying this word in a very British accent like Peppa does, why would they continue to maintain that, right? It doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, so you've also researched and written about internet vernacular in the last year or two. So could you tell us what it is and why you don't just call it slang?
Okay, that's a good question. Okay, so I really dislike the term slang. I don't think it's a sociolinguistic concept. I think it's a lay concept. Mm-hmm. And my issue with slang is it's just lexis. It's just words, right? Mm-hmm. So why can't we just call it lexis? It's just that those words might have not been standardized. They might not have been put in the dictionary. And when we think about why they might not have been put in the dictionary or what communities use them, it's mainly minoritized communities, right? Like we think about most things that now people problematically describe as like Gen Z language or slang. And a lot of those words are from African American vernacular English via the queer community, right? So like slay or ate it up, all these phrases, they're originally from Av, and then the queer community started to use this style too. And now it's just at the point where many people don't even recognize those indexicalities. They just see it as Gen Z language. We're actually working on a paper on this at the moment. And so I think internet vernacular gives me a way to describe what people think of as internet styles of language. And I don't think they are precisely bounded to the internet, but that's not the point. People think of them. So like I'm interested in like metapragmatic discourses, which is like language about language. And so it doesn't matter whether it's accurate or like what's actually going on, but people think of these words like slay or ate it up as TikTok language. You often see people describe it precisely as so.
Yeah.
So I know that there's a longer history than that, but in order to kind of to frame what I think is going on, I think we should just define this as lexis. Like these are just words. It's just they haven't been standardized or received the kind of level of codification that other words might have done.
Yeah.
And does that help kind of distance you from the more negative kind of connotations of slang as something that's kind of improper and, you know, that we should be perhaps encouraging our young people not to use?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think, like, if you look at, like, slang bands, for instance, in school, where you look at those words, and, like, a lot of them are just words from other languages or, like, from minoritized groups, right? And, like, framing these as slang is problematic to me because it kind of degenerates those words, right? Like those words are useful to the communities who use them. And by framing it as slang, you're suggesting that it's in some way, like, you know, more colloquial or more informal, when actually lots of these words don't have colloquial associations in the communities that use them, right? Yeah. So I think we need to think about more just like this is lexis, it's words, and some words are used by some communities, some words are used by another, right? Like, yeah.
So I guess that sort of leads into that discussion as well about appropriation. I mean, is that something that you feel is a kind of useful term with this, or is that maybe too kind of too, what's the word?
Political, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's got those kind of heavy connotations, doesn't it?
So I have written about like linguistic appropriation, and I think it's a thing that we as sociolinguists have massively under-theorized. Like, I think this is probably one of the contributions of my work going forward, is to try and provide a definition of linguistic appropriation, because lots of people talk about like language contact and diffusion, but they don't think about linguistic appropriation within those contexts. And within my work, it's very clear to see some forms of linguistic appropriation where you have, like in social media context, like communities who never come into contact with that speech community appropriating their style. So like, for instance, my work on like the use of African-American vernacular English amongst white gay men, right? It's not just that they're using features of Av, they're using features of Av because they're like problematically associated with particular beliefs or thoughts about Black women, right? Like, so for me, calling that appropriation is quite fine to do, because I think that has the kind of more politically loaded history.
That's the Sassy Queen's
work. Yeah, that's the one. So like, I think now we're at a stage where lots of what people consider to be Gen Z language or TikTok language, where a lot of it has come from African American vernacular English. And I think what we can do is say the process by which we've got Av now as being perceived as that is through linguistic appropriation. But I don't feel comfortable, I don't think it's accurate to say that like a 12-year-old kid who says like slay or eat it up is appropriating, because that doesn't, well, I mean, if you speak to young people, you know that they have no clue that these came from that, right? And that is a separate issue. But I don't think that is appropriation. Sociolinguistics, when we theorize appropriation, it's people who are doing it intentionally for some kind of you know, commercial or symbolic gain.
Yes.
And so, like, for instance, paper, like my MA thesis looked at Iggy Azalea, the Australian hip-hop artist who raps in very, very amazingly coherent ab, right? She had adheres to all these amazing internal constraints that many ab speakers have. That, to me, very clearly is a case of an individual appropriating language to get some commercial gain. Whereas I think what's going on with young people is, like, there was this linguistic appropriation at a high level, like systematic level, and now young people are just part of using a language style that they see and hear from their mates. Mm. And that is slightly different, I think.
Yeah. So I suppose an example of, I mean, there's the Iggy Azalea example that you could say, you know, appropriation for commercial gain. There's also, is there maybe the ways in which this, you talked about kind of metapragmatic discourses,
yeah,
so language around language, maybe the sort of headlines where we see about MLE and things like that from the Mail, where they seem absolutely fixated on Wagwan as like their kind of buzzword that symbolizes MLE.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing as well, where they're kind of appropriating that for a different kind of effect, kind of mockery?
Yeah. So I think with MLE, two things are going on, right? Where there are direct forms of appropriation of MLE, and like the media are particularly bad for this. Like you say, like, I don't know why Wagwan, well, I think I do know why Wagwan like is what they think of as MLE, because it's, you know, a feature from Jamaican English that's directly borrowed. It's probably one of the more racialized features of MLE. It has social meanings of blackness. So I think that word is often used because it distinguishes that variety of English from what we might think of as ideologically white varieties of English. So you see that word often being used when they talk about like the displacement of Cockney, for instance, or we're all going to be speaking this style, which, you know, for various reasons is not accurate. But yeah.
So that kind of leads on a little bit into some other things you've been involved with as well. So you've been involved with the Accent Bias Britain project at QMUL, where you previously worked. And you've worked on projects associated with MLE as well, including your Stylizing the Roadman paper.
Mm.
What's been happening with MLE recently? And, you know, sort of touching on some of the debates we've had with, for example, you know, we talked with Paul Kurzweil, we talked with F.A. Thompson about this.
Mm-hmm.
Should we even be calling it MLE? What's your sort of take on all of that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think a lot has been happening with MLE, and I think what we see now is something that was slightly different to what was initially described by Cheshire and colleagues. So like now, very clearly, multicultural London English is symbolically, indexically associated with Black cultural forms, right? Like grime music, for instance, it's pretty synonymous with grime music. It's pretty synonymous with like road culture, which I've spoken about in my Roadman paper. So that is a Black British interpretation of North American street cultures. And so I think we now have like a variety of English that is very closely linked with the Black British identity. And so whether we should call it Black British English or not, I think we need to think about the trajectory of this variety, how it was used maybe 30 years ago, and how speakers use it today. So I guess the other thing to say is, like, at least in my work, when you talk to MLE speakers, they don't call it MLE, right? Because this is an academic term. And so I think ideally we'd use a term that MLE speakers would use themselves. But in my experience, and I know Paul's had this, I know Siobhan found this too, like MLE speakers will just call it slang, right? Like as we might expect. And so I think that the label multicultural London English is accurate to describe a variety of English that is used by young people, or actually all people, from diverse linguistic and cultural backgrounds. And I think that's what the empirical evidence shows, is that, you know, like if you're a young second generation Turkish guy living in Hackney, you grow up, you're going to say fess for face, right? Or you're going to say like lie for lie. Right. This is your phonology because everyone around you speaks this variety that emerged in London. So I think what MLE does is localizes it to London. I think it's really important to say that this is a London variety. Like my work with Jack Grieve and David Hall, where we use a very large Twitter data set to track the diffusion, like this is a London variety and it has diffused. But I think we should really be like proud about the fact that you came from London, and it makes sense with regard to social demographic changes in London. Whereas Black British English suggests that this is a variety that's used across the whole of Britain. I live in Scotland, and that doesn't seem to be the case, right? Like, if you speak to Black people here, they're not using multicultural London English or multicultural British English. And our study with Jack Grieve and David Hall shows that, right? Like, it is very much an English variety. And sure, it's spread in different ways now, primarily, I think, through like cultural forms like grime music, etc. The thing that's like something slightly different to what we're talking about here. So I don't know. For me, I think we are talking about like some forms of, and that's what my paper tries to argue, is like a type of recontextualization. And so in order to like debate whether it's NLE or BBE, I think we need to ensure that we're on the same page. We need to make sure that we're talking about the same thing. We linguists think of this as a variety that's characterized by several linguistic features, like phonological features, like lexical features, like syntactic features. Whereas when you see people talk about this in media, they often just refer to the lexis, right? Mm-hmm. Like lots of media commentators will describe NLE as like a street parlance or like slang, right? And that is just words. And if we're talking about the words, then sure, like, yeah, okay. Like basically the whole lexicon of NLE is from Jamaican English and other varieties of what we consider to be, you know, Black Englishes. So I think that is pretty straightforward. But the phonology and the syntax, I mean, there's not much clear evidence for where some of those features are from. So I think it's to ensure that we're kind of making reference to what Cheshire and colleagues refer to as the feature pool, right? Like that you had all these heritage languages put in, like Cockney, Jamaican English, like Indian English, like Arabic, to ensure that we're kind of being honest to how MLE was probably formed. I'd suggest that it's actually better to maintain the term multicultural London English and then perhaps question whether there are ethnic differences within MLE. Like, I mean, like I said earlier, I think Siobhan Gates in her thesis argues this really convincingly, that you have this like general umbrella term, MLE, and then within it, you have perhaps ethnolinguistic repertoires, right? So you might have a more what we consider to be like and registered as like a Black MLE or like a white MLE version. I think it is important to kind of confirm though that like kids living in that area, they will grow up speaking this variety because that's how people speak in those areas.
Yeah.
And so white kids, Black kids, kids with diverse background from the UK, outside of the UK. And so I think it is important to maintain the term NLE, but then say that, yeah, there is likely going to be ethnic differences within that variety.
Yeah. And I think I was just having a look at, we talked to Siobhan back in probably like episode 4, I think it was, about some of her work. It was really interesting. That was the stuff she did around Newham, wasn't it?
Yeah. So like in a store in Newham, so a similar ethnographic project.
Yeah. And I think there was that was quite interesting as well, because I think there'd been that sort of discussion about MLE as being ethnically neutral, wasn't it, originally? Yeah. And her argument was, no, it's not.
So me and Siobhan have always agreed on this, and I've always long been critical of this conclusion. I just don't think it's ethnically neutral. I don't think it perhaps ever was. But like at least the approach that Jenny and Paul were using, which is like a macro approach where you look, like, does this group use it? Does this group use it? The answer was no. So at least from their approach, it looks ethnically neutral. But I think, you know, ethnic social meanings can operate at a much more abstract level. And so that kind of conclusion that it's ethnically neutral, I don't think takes into account the fact that it might be, as we see now, even if in practice it's used by multiple people, it might be perceived as Black, right? People, you know, called it Jafakan very early on. And I think that's why, you know, multicultural London English, I don't think it's a perfect term, but it's definitely better than Jafakan, right?
Yes. It's quite interesting hearing it, how it's kind of translated across to the US as well, because with the success of Top Boy and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like in my paper on The Roadman, it's like, people don't, outside the UK, they don't hear this as like a variety. They're now seeing it as like in, and this is in, you know, scare quotes, like roadman language, right? Because it has TikTok, these kind of parodic performances have had such a major impact on how people perceive it. So that is one of those instances where, sure, social media might not lead directly to language change, but it does reconfigure how people hear and perceive speakers, which definitely has implications for sociolinguistics.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Christian, what are you working on now, where is it taking you?
Yeah, so I'm doing two projects at the moment. Oh, I'm actually writing a student textbook on digital communication that I've almost finished. So this is, I forgot about that.
That sounds really useful.
Yeah. So actually, I wrote this when I spoke to loads of secondary school teachers who want to teach about like digital communication at secondary, like GCSE level, but they're like, you know, the content is still, I know, like focused on like David Crystal's work, right? Yeah. And a lot of them were like, your work is really interesting, but sometimes it's like impenetrable, or like it's difficult to make sense of like A and B. And like, my sister's an English teacher. So I've written this book, sure, for like undergrad students, but it's actually probably going to be more useful for like, for students doing these language investigations, where I've basically written out the history of the field and what we're doing now, and then separated it into these different approaches that hopefully students would be able to use to design their own projects. So I'm kind of hoping that it would be useful to especially secondary school students. So that's one thing. And then I have two projects on TikTok, because I spend a lot of time on TikTok. And I also think that TikTok is like a goldmine for sociolinguistics. And so one of those projects, I've been working with somebody, a friend who's a lecturer at Loughborough in sports science, on how gay people talk about their experiences of PE lessons on TikTok. And then the second project I'm working on is actually linked to what we're talking about today. It's about appropriation of African-American vernacular English and how TikTok creators respond to that. So we're interested in, these metapragmatic discourses. So some people argue on the app that this is just, you know, it's just language change. People have used words from different communities all the time. And some people argue that this is appropriation, and we're basically trying to pick apart these discourses.
Right. So onto the quickfire questions, which are often the trickiest ones. What's your favorite book about language?
Yeah, so I thought about this and I had to think quite long and hard. And then I thought, actually, I'm going to suggest a book that is about language, but it's also about social practice, because that's how I see language, right? And this book like heavily influenced my PhD. It influenced my thought process, and it's Mendoza Denton's Homegirls. So, you know, most linguistic anthropologists or linguistic ethnographers will at some point reference this book. And I think it's really important because it brings together a field that I was trained in, language variation change, and also linguistic anthropology. And, you know, like, even though I think it's now 15 or so years old, it's still relevant, highly relevant to what we're talking about now. And lots of the insights, you know, I think are just really engaging and at a level of ethnographic depth that is really impressive.
Yeah. I've got a feeling that was Rob Drummond's favorite book as well.
Oh, really? Yes. That doesn't surprise me. It's like, I imagine that most people who were trained as variationists and then became more like, you know, social practice, linguistic ethnographers will refer to this book.
So what about your favorite linguistic fact or idea?
So I think my favorite linguistic fact is actually something that we teach first years very early on, but it's one of those things that I think when you learn about, it kind of blows your mind that it's a thing. So we know that plurals are generally formed by adding the S, right? The suffix S. So in a word like cats and dogs, we know that there are more than one cat or one dog, because we've added this suffix that is represented in spelling with this letter S. But I think what I find like still to this day really interesting is that S, right, it's depends on the voicing of the previous phoneme. So in a word like cats, right, we have a voiceless phoneme there, right? Cats, because the preceding phoneme t is voiceless, whereas in dogs, because we have a g there before what the suffix is, we get a voiced phoneme, so dogs. And I think, you know, like you go through life not really noticing this, and even that level of awareness very early on in first year, I think to many students is a really kind of mind-blowing moment when they realize that, sure, it's the same letter, but actually they're two different sounds, and those sounds are predicted by the voicing of the preceding segment.
Great.
What one bit of advice would you give a budding linguist?
So I think I say this to, like, I do a lot of, like, you know, outreach talks and talks with teenagers at school, and I always say this, it's like, you're probably already a linguist. You in the classroom, you know, at school, you know that that group say the word, like, I don't know, like peng, and your group would never say that. And that is linguistic difference. And you can ask yourself why that is, and you probably know why that is, right? Like, they're the cool group. We're like, I'm using personal experience here, like, I'm the geek, right? And we don't use those words, right? And the question is then, is like, what we're basically doing in linguistics is giving you the tools and language to be able to describe those processes. So I think I would encourage budding linguists, like, your positionality, your experience actually is so rich and so important to our field. And you training, like, at a high level, whether that be like A-level English language or whether it be like at a degree level, the purpose of that is to basically give you, yeah, the language to be able to describe what's going on.
Right. And that's why teaching A-level language is, it's just really good fun, because it changes every year, doesn't it? You know,
yeah.
the examples that you're discussing, and the never example I bring, that, you know, I always feel like I'm learning more every year, and the examples that the students bring are like, well, that's different to last year. And this example that last year had, they're like, no, we don't see that anymore.
Yeah.
Keeps you on your toes.
I can remember it was probably about 3 years ago, loads of the students were saying, and are you? And then you said,
yeah, and
are you?
Yeah.
They were like, oh, no. But
that's from a meme of a drag queen originally. So,
Wasn't it? It's
interesting how, like, those references get folded into everyday conversation.
Yeah, because I'd never come across it. And then when I brought it back up, I'm like, is this still going? And they're like, no.
It's interesting how short-lived some of those things are.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thanks very much, Christian. That's really fascinating
stuff. No problem. I also realised that Norma Mendoza Denton's book is much, much older than I thought. It's 2000. I guess that's testament to how, you know, like, relevant it is today, all these years later. It's like, well, it's 25 years old or such, but yeah, it's still incredibly relevant to what we're talking about now.
Yeah. No, cheers, Christian. That's fantastic. Well, thanks a lot for doing this.
No worries. Anytime. It was really interesting.
We love you and your work, your ace.
Thanks. Cheers.